and you are tuned in to Thursday Night Talk right here on KHSU. Tonight, Sharon Fennell is our host with the next edition of On the Line. As always, we welcome your contributions. Please give us a call at 826-4805. If you're out of the area, toll-free at 800-640-5911 and to our text line at 492-KHSU.
Good evening, and welcome to Thursday Night Talk with Sharon Fennell. I'm Troy Williams. I'll be hosting the show with her this evening. Before we go on, I'd like to make an announcement. In honor of Black History Month, the NAACP in Eureka has sponsored a book drive. The book drive will last from February the 1st to the 25th, and it's hosting a Black History Month as a way to engage with the local community. We are collecting books for 3 weeks in February with the goal of 200 books about Black history, Black culture, or Black authors. At the end of the month, these books will be donated to a local elementary or in high school. Students are encouraged to get involved. There's a drop-off point, and it is at KHSU, Lorna Bryant, also at the African American Center for Academic Excellence, and Humboldt County Office of Education and the Arcata Library. So hopefully you guys have some books out there. Another announcement also by the NAACP is a writing contest. It's called Stay Woke. And the essay contest will last between February the 1st and the 25th, and it's open to all HSU students. And the topic is this: what does the term Stay Woke mean to you within the context of Black history? Again, what does the term Stay Woke mean to you within the context of Black history? Email submissions can be sent to contact@eurekanaacp.org. And there's a $300 first place prize. There'll be two honorable mention prizes for $50 plus gift cards to a local restaurant. And the requirements are you must be a current HSU student, and we ask that you submit it in 12-point double-spaced, two-page maximum. And the winners will be announced at the end of the month. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Well, good evening to you, and welcome to On the Line Thursday Night Talk. Today marks the beginning of Black History Month. During the month, we celebrate and recognize the achievements of past, present, of our country's Black brothers and sisters. It's a sad fact that the United States of America incarcerates more people than just about any country in the world. We have less than 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's total prison population. Black men are locked up at a rate 6 times higher than that of white men. Someone who knows a lot about mass incarceration is my guest for the hour, and my co-host, Troy Williams. My guest is Scott Budnick. Scott is the founder of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. Your calls are welcome at any time. The number is 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. Scott, welcome back to KHSU Airwaves, and thank you for taking the time to talk about incarceration and your amazing efforts in creating rehabilitation programs. How are you doing?
Man, this is so unbelievably exciting to be back with you and with Troy. I'm so excited to be here and be on the air with you, sis.
Yeah, and this is a nice format. We can stretch it out. People can call in who want to speak to you, maybe more in detail than I'm about to, but we'll see how that goes. I hope people do call in because,
you know. Yeah, I'd love to take some calls.
Good, right on. So, Scott, let's begin at the beginning of your transcendence from a Hollywood film. I was going to say mogul, but I'll just say producer. To the work that you and your organization are doing today. Were you just ready to retire from making movies?
I mean, it wasn't that simple. Back in the day when I was doing my second movie, which was called Old School, another producer asked me to come down to a juvenile hall in Los Angeles and be a part of a creative writing program. And so I went down on a Saturday in 2004 and sat at a table with about 12 kids facing life sentences in prison. And the kid next to me, this great kid named David, I asked him how he's doing, and he said, well, I'm not doing too good. I just got sentenced to 300 years to life in prison at 15 years old for standing next to my friend that shot the victim in the rear end.
Oh.
And for standing next to his friend, he got a 300 to life sentence, and he was just a child, and he looked like a child, and he had the hopes and dreams and fears of a child, and I just knew, being in the film business, in our little bubble that we're in that's not real, and then coming smack dab face to face with just the realness of injustice, made me crazy. And I just knew with my ability to get certain people on the phone and use the power of the film business to do good and help people, that I just couldn't sit back and watch this kid go to prison for 300 to life. So I ended up teaching that class. There was an incredible kid named Adam in that class who was going to prison for 6 years, and he looked at about 11 years old. And I just committed to all those kids in that juvenile hall that if they're willing to make the changes in their life to find success and happiness for them and their family, like, I was willing to stay with them the entire ride, whether it was a 2-year sentence, a life without parole sentence, that I was there till the day I die. And fast forward, that kid Adam that did 6 years in prison was my prop assistant on The Hangover. And he ended up out hustling everybody on that set and got into the union. He now makes about $150,000 a year and just bought a house for his family.
Oh, nice.
But it was doing this type of work and diving into the juvenile system and the adult criminal justice system and following these incredible young people through this journey and watching them grow and change and evolve, and then being able to be alongside them when they came home, that led for me to say, 16 years after making movies, that I wanted to dedicate my life to helping the people that were behind bars. And I see it as public safety. We'll ultimately have a safer community if people change and rehabilitate while they're inside, and then have that helping hand when they come home to help them integrate and help them. I mean, some of these folks that we're working with here at ARC have been down 30, 40 years. Jack Morris was sitting at our front desk today welcoming people to the ARC office, and Jack spent 40 years in prison and 37 years in the Pelican Bay SHU. To just be alongside Jack's journey and assisting him in this transition, it's just every day. I always say I took a 90% pay cut 5 years ago, and the last 5 years have been the happiest 5 years of my life.
I hear you. I hear you. I know the feeling quite well, Scott. Of being, being with Jack and what that means to you. You know, I'm going to just share a little tiny experience and then ask you your feelings about this. When I first went to visit Troy, it was up at Pelican Bay. And first time in a California, no, it wasn't the first time I was in a California prison. I take that back, but in a maximum security prison. And my husband and I went into the visiting room, and I was struck by the look of the population, meaning black and brown, all surrounded by me. And that was like, whoa, this is very visual. And then when I went to see Troy in San Quentin, it was like 99% black men. And you walk into this visiting room and you just have to like wonder and ask yourself, huh? This is just like too much to conceive. And so I'm wondering how, you know, when you went into that juvenile hall, besides that you saw children who, you know, people were never going to let them see the light of day, but children, a room full of kids, did you like go home and, I don't know, cry? Because that's how I felt. Like, how could we do this? Just the visual of it.
Yeah, it's funny, the kind of the first half of the time I've been doing this work, I didn't really talk much about the racial element of it because I felt like that was very divisive. And I was a little bit ignorant. I mean, not ignorant to like the root causes and what it looks like, because when I went in Los Angeles, it is brown and black.
Yeah.
I mean, it is all people of color. But it wasn't until I went to Rwanda in Africa and into Germany where I really got it. And what was fascinating to me is that in Rwanda, the people that are incarcerated are all African. They're all black. And the population's all black. So when they talk about the folks that are incarcerated in their country, they say they're Rwandans, they're neighbors. We need to do everything we can to help them, to heal them, because they're part of our community. And it is, and they've created an entire system around resocialization and rehabilitation because they see the people in their prisons as part of their community. And then I went to Germany literally weeks later, and you go into German prison is everyone is white European and the population's white European. And they say, you know what? These are Germans. They made a mistake. We need to rehabilitate them. We need to resocialize them, and we need to help them integrate back into society because they're our neighbors. They're our community. We love them. And in Germany, the first line of their constitution is the purpose of prison is resocialization, and that punishment is not allowed to be used. The loss of freedom alone is the punishment.
Yeah.
Well, contrast that to the United States, where the majority of our public are not people of color, and the majority of our prisoners are, and we say that these are not people that are part of our community. We must put them behind a cage. We must forget about them. We must punish them, so much so that the first line of the California Penal Code, up until we changed it a year ago, said the purpose of prison is punishment. Because we did not see those who are incarcerated as our community, as our neighbors, as the people we love. We saw them as people that we must separate from our community to keep our community safe. And it wasn't until seeing that stark contrast that I got comfortable talking about the racial overtones in the prisons, because it is the new Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
It is the new version of slavery.
Yeah.
And meeting these folks in prison, I've just met some of the most beautiful and wonderful people that are my neighbors, that are my community, that I want to live next door to me. And I've found anyone that we bring into the prisons to meet the folks or into ARC to meet people who have come home, no matter where they fall on the political spectrum or how they felt before they came in here, they change. And as Bryan Stevenson, the great author who wrote Just Mercy, says, like, if you want to change the world, you need to bring people proximate to human suffering.
Yeah.
And to me, bringing people into prisons and bringing people to meet people who were in prison, that's bringing people proximate. And 100% of the time, they change.
Yeah, yep, yep. And by the way, Scott, you're doing this because you're a natural storyteller, but I wanted to make sure that you understood, since we have such a lovely amount of time, that just share stories that you hold, you know, dear to your heart, and shed light on these great stories that you have, so that those of us who don't know about this world, what happens when we lock people up and throw away the keys, and what happens when we don't? What happens when we don't throw away the keys, like in the work that you're doing? I want our listeners to hear more about that. Troy, you got anything for Scott right now?
Yeah, but before, maybe we should give the listeners a number to call. 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. Yeah, I want to say that the work that Scott and people like Scott are doing, it's like feeding the soul of the men that are and women that are in there, because you have enough voices in there that are already telling them that you guys are not a part of community, you're not a part of the public anymore, and you know, everyone wants you here, you know. So if you're in there and you're hearing that consistently every day, you know, and you don't have a voice to, how should you say, counteract that, then you start to believe that and you start to act out in certain ways that are destructive, and you know, and then pretty soon you're at a point where you're looking at society is like, yeah, well, you know, I'm not a part of society anymore, you know. So, you know, what Scott is doing is helping the men and the women in there to realize that, hey, okay, you're behind this wall for right now, but you still have a society that has you right there as their interest, you know, and there's still that welcoming hand there for you, you know, because a lot of guys up until recently, they weren't feeling that at all.
Yeah,
you couldn't have said it better, Troy. And trust me, my man, it's you and the folks that have been through this system and have come out on the other end. I mean, this is my inspiration. I always say that when I worked at Warner Brothers, I worked with the real criminals.
I found, and
that's a joke. There's some lovely people, Warner Brothers.
Of course.
But I found the most moral, intelligent, creative, beautiful, good-hearted, kind-hearted people that I've met behind bars. The first time I was in Pelican Bay, I walked into the SHU, and we had passed, ARC and Human Rights Watch had passed a bill to end life sentences for young people called Senate Bill 260 and to give them a chance of parole. And we were doing a seminar up in Pelican Bay in the SHU. And we had all these men in solitary confinement in these cages, and we were going one by one and talking to them. And I was talking to this 60-year-old man, and I told him, I said, "Sir, I don't know if you know this, but because of this bill, you're immediately eligible for parole." And this man started weeping.
Wow.
And mind you, these are the people they call the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
This man started weeping, and he said, "This is the first day in 40 years I've ever had any hope." And that, you know, you hear Troy, and you know it better than anybody, right? That, like, that word hope is so powerful. Having tangible hope
exactly.
is so powerful.
Exactly.
That's what inspires change and growth and transformation. And he put his little pinky finger through the cage, and I put my pinky finger through, and we shook pinky fingers.
Yeah,
and he said, "You're
days.
The first person that I've touched in 30 years.
Oh, man.
And it was just one of the most unbelievable moments I've ever had in my life. And then, like, cut to a lot of these folks coming out as lifers and coming into ARC down here in Southern California and up in Sacramento when they first come home. And they walk through their door for the first time in 20, 30, 40 years. And, like, just to be able to greet them and hug them and welcome them home and listen to them and hear about the experience and to talk to them about their hopes for the future and to talk to them about their fears for the future and to see these little successes, to see them get into a union construction job or to see them graduate a four-year university or to see them just going through community college or going into the film business or working a plumbing job or a firefighting job. It's just like, There's nothing that brings me joy more than seeing these unbelievable people just find happiness out here in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're making the best of the second opportunity they've been given, you know. And that's when I was in there, that was my desire right there, just to have the opportunity to get out and to make the best of being free again, you know. And that meant, you know, seeing community as part of me. And it meant, you know, helping a hand when I seen somebody that needed help. And it meant, you know, ultimately working hard, you know, and showing that, hey, you know what, you know, I'm industrious, you know, I'm grateful of this freedom, you know, and, you know, I'm a part of, you know, society, you know.
Yeah. And I want to just say, Troy, there's probably any number of people listening who have never heard you before. You know, you never know who's tuned in right now. And they may not know what you've had to endure. Can you give 30 seconds on
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Well, I was a resident of the CDC for a couple of decades, plus a few more years added on. And I was finally able to leave the prison system, and you know, I'm here, I'm in the community now, I'm going to the university, and you know, I'm making the best of it, you know. And I just wish that, you know, there's so many other people in there that I wish that they could have this opportunity as well, you know.
Yep. So Scott, did and we'll get we'll do this in a couple of different ways, but I want to know about how the Anti-Recidivism Coalition was actually birthed. But my question is, did you go up to Pelican Bay first and experience solitary confinement and then came the organization, or the other way around?
The other way around. I started the organization because as I was teaching this creative writing class every Saturday, I had dozens of kids every month going into the adult prison system, and every year there'd be hundreds going in, and then miraculously a couple years later people started to come home, and we grew to about 30 people that had come home, but they were spread all throughout Southern California. And so we started holding these retreats where we would get a campsite, say in Santa Barbara, and we would have a retreat over a weekend where it would be everything from surfing to baseball to basketball to meditation to yoga to college guidance to all these sort of things. And there were all these wonderful volunteers, prison chaplains, teachers that were coming in and being a part of these retreats with the men and women who were incarcerated. And it just kept growing organically till we had about 100 members at these retreats, and there was still no nonprofit. There was no ARC. And Governor Schwarzenegger, Troy, you may remember this, Governor Schwarzenegger cut $300 million out of the prison program budget.
Yeah, I do remember.
And this was also after Gray Davis, you'll remember this one as well, said in the L.A. Times,
he would never let anyone out.
Yeah, if you're a lifer, the only way you're coming home is in a pine box.
I do remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And when Governor Schwarzenegger cut the $300 million, we had a college program where there's about 6,000 men and women in California prisons who were full-time college students. And it was only $2 million of funding to fund this college program. And he cut it, and everyone had lost their ability to enroll in college. And then, honestly, I'm on the set of The Hangover in Vegas, and I'm getting 30 collect calls in a day of people literally saying, school saved my life. It changed my identity. It gave me hope. And now I'm being told I can't enroll. And I coordinated a conference call with the president of the Senate, Daryl Steinberg, mm-hmm. and eight of our members who were in prison and did college in prison and now were out in the community, in community college or university. And we had a 20-minute phone call with the president of the Senate where they simply told their story. This is who I was as a teenager and how I got in trouble. Mm-hmm. I went to prison, college changed my life, and now I'm home and I'm at Cal State LA. I'm at UCLA, whatever the story was. And he was so blown away by those stories that he said, right now I'm restoring the $2 million for the college program in the budget. Because of your transformations, you've given me hope that this is going to change many more lives. And the entire college program was saved.
Wow.
And it's when the light bulb went off in my head that, sure, the producer of The Hangover can do his little thing and can get people on the phone, but I need to learn when to shut up and let the remarkable stories be told and just be a conduit to just incredible storytelling.
Yes.
And after that, a couple Jesuit priests asked us to come up because they had a bill in the legislature to end life without parole sentences for juveniles. And that bill could not pass 7 years in a row. And all the bill did was give a juvenile a parole hearing at 25 years, or even a chance to go in front of a judge and get a parole hearing. After serving 25 uh-huh. years, and still zero Republicans and 12 Democrats would not vote for the bill. All Republicans wouldn't vote for it, and 12 Democrats wouldn't vote for it. And I brought that same group up to Sacramento that spoke to Senator Steinberg, and we went and met with the 12 Democrats who weren't voting for the bill. And in that one day, we got the final two votes and passed that bill after 7 years. And now every juvenile that had a life without parole sentence were now able to go to court and get a parole hearing. And because of that, a bunch of foundations came together and said, listen, you got the money restored for the college program. You helped pass SB9. We've met so many of your incredible members around town. You need to turn this into an organization, both to help people when they come home, but also to change policies in Sacramento, locally, et cetera. And that's when ARC was born in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Since we're talking about legislation, let me jump to that. You know that there are men listening up in Pelican Bay right now, and maybe some of them don't know that they would benefit from SB 9, SB 260, 261. So for their benefit, would you talk a little bit about those legislative victories and how it might apply to some of our listeners up in Pelican Bay?
Absolutely. So everyone, Democrat and Republican alike, have understood the brain science that young people do stupid things. They have poor judgment. They don't think of consequences. Anyone listening that has a child know how stupid in terms of just street smarts that young people are. That the brain is not fully developed until the mid-20s. So we were able to pass four consecutive pieces of legislation with many other community partners alongside us. So it was really a huge movement, and it was a bipartisan movement. Newt Gingrich helped us. Grover Norquist helped us. The Koch brothers helped us. Because they all believe that young people should have the chance to prove transformation, to prove change, and that a young person shouldn't be held accountable till the day they die for an act they did when they were young, that they could change, they could transform, and they could be people of great character. And we were able to pass this legislation, which gave all of them who were set to die in prison now the chance of parole after 15, 20, or 25 years, age 25 and under. And Governor Brown has paroled thousands of them, and I'm happy to say that they are the least recidivating population in all of CDCR. They have a 1% recidivism rate. So literally giving someone the chance of parole after 15, 20, or 25 years when they're young, they come home and they have so much gratitude and they've spent so much time changing that they literally never go back.
Yeah.
And we were able to then pass Prop 57 that then gives them milestones and credits for college diplomas and high school diplomas and self-help programs, et cetera. And now we're embarking on another year of legislation where we plan to do a lot more.
We'll talk about that in a second. My guest is Scott Budnick. He's the founder of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, and I'm co-hosting today with Troy Williams, who spent way too much time behind bars. You can call us at 826-4805 right now, or 1-800-640-5911. We'll take calls anytime. Don't feel like you're interrupting, but be more interesting to hear what you guys have to say or want to know of Scott or Troy, for that matter.
You know, I have a question for Scott. Hey, Scott. Have you experienced a lot of pushback from your organization? You know, are there voices out there that are saying, well, you know what, you know, we don't think this organization should even exist for people that's been in prison, because once they've committed a crime, they shouldn't have anyone supporting them. Have you gotten a lot of pushback like that?
You know, it's so funny you say that. I mean, there's some of that at first, but I just really like, having some of those uncomfortable conversations are I think where we need to be. We're also used to preaching to the choir and the people that agree with us, and I would rather spend the entire day talking to people that don't agree with me, because I know, because I see this and I spend so much time in the prisons, like I know that with experience and with personal experience they will change. And so yes, we've had some folks that were like that. Mm-hmm. But again, it's easy to be that way when you don't see the people on the other end as human.
Exactly.
The second you have a relationship and you see someone's human and you can like see someone, touch them, hug them, etc., and hear their stories and hear their remorse and hear their change, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And Troy, I mean, I know you went through the whole thing, and I know whenever someone meets you and sees your heart and your soul and your intelligence and everything you're doing right here, that you are a huge asset to the community, that you're there giving back, that you're stopping kids from going down the same path, that you are a credible messenger and these kids listen to you because you were once that kid. And to be so ignorant as to not realize the value that you, Troy, have in helping the next generation and what you're doing educationally and out in the workforce and with your family and with all of us. I mean, the world is so beautiful to have you out in it. The world, by the way, 25 years ago, that might not have been the case.
Exactly.
But you're not who you were 25 years ago.
Yeah, 25 years ago, I was one of those kids in juvenile hall that were thrown away, and you can feel it, too. You can feel, like, hey, we have been thrown away, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of love for Arnold Schwarzenegger because this is so unusual. Scott, you may know this, but most people, when they go up for their parole hearings, they don't usually make it on the first round. You know, you go to the parole board and they go, yeah, you seem okay, but we'll see you in 3 years or 5 years, come back. But Troy, first time he went, the board granted him parole, but Schwarzenegger said nay. So he had to wait until the next parole when Jerry Brown was in, and Jerry Brown said, sure. So, you know, here he sits. It took a long time, though, and he should have never been in there in the first place, but that's a story for another day. I love your enthusiasm, Scott, because, you know, I know what you know. I mean, you're out there, and I envy you. I wish I could be in your back pocket going to all these places. But I understand your enthusiasm and your heart, and it's right. And if, you know, we could duplicate you a whole bunch of times, that would be great. And also the people that help you do this work, because you're not a one-man show. I know how talented you are, but you couldn't do this without people who support you and your organization and the individuals that you bring home. So I just want to tell you how much I appreciate that you're in this world too. And that you're doing this work, because somebody had to get this thing going in the way that you have. So, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition does a lot of different things, and I have all this in front of me, you know, that I could spout. But why don't you talk to us about that, and then we're going to talk about good films. So, All right. So, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. Who gets to be a part of it?
Obviously all of our members, right now about 600 members, 500 to 600 members, all formerly incarcerated,
wow,
all throughout the state of California. Everyone signs a commitment to strive to be crime-free, drug-free, in school and working and willing to be of service to their community. And we have two really distinct sides, or maybe three distinct sides of what we do. The first is just pure reentry. When someone comes home, do they need housing? We have two supportive housing programs across the street from community colleges where 60 people can live together, work together, go to school together, and support one another. And we have full staffing and wraparound services and counseling alongside those housing programs. We have about 20 employers that will constantly employ our folks without worrying about criminal record, from Starbucks to the Cheesecake Factory to Home Depot to the Staples Center where the Lakers and the Kings and the Clippers play. We have the only construction union apprenticeship program in the state where we pay people $15 an hour just to train, and then we give them guaranteed placement into six different construction unions, and we guarantee them their first union job. And we've now placed over 100 people in the last year into those construction unions with incredible impact. We have programs that we partner with that get people directly into the unions in the film and television business. So, and we now are, and I think this is new information, we are starting, for the first time in the history of California, the first ever program to get people with felonies and people coming out of prisons, jails, and juvenile halls directly into wildland firefighting careers with LA County Fire and with Cal Fire. And we're going to be starting in the fall bringing on 80 people who have come out of incarceration to to be state firefighters.
Wow.
Fighting all these fires that have been destroying our communities. And as you know, so many of these folks have already been fighting fires and saving communities while they've been incarcerated. And to say that they can risk their lives and fight fires and be the saviors of communities while they're still inmates, but then cannot get a job and a career being a firefighter when they get out, now that to me is slavery. So you are going to see, in partnership with this incredible governor and Cal Fire and the Department of Corrections and the Conservation Corps, the governor just announced in his budget that he is putting aside $23 million to start the first ever pipeline of people from prison directly into fire careers. And ARC is going to be running that program. And we're just so excited about that. Alongside those programs, we have mentoring programs where we pair people coming out of prison, jails, and juvenile halls with adult mentors that help guide them in their lives and their careers. We have counseling, therapy. We do everything to heal people from their traumas, from their abuse, from their childhoods, from the violence that they've seen, from the trauma that they've experienced in prison, from one-on-one therapy to support groups to member-led groups to healing circles to sweat lodges. And we really prioritize the healing of our members to get out the stuff that they've experienced and to be able to get on with their new life. That's the reentry side. Obviously, we have the policy side where we've passed the bills that we've discussed and are now working on bills to end the felony murder rule and to help people who were aiders and abettors during the crime and were not the actual shooters. We're working on legislation to stop 14 and 15-year-olds from being sent into the adult system. We're working on legislation to look at enhancements, gun enhancements, and gang enhancements, which really drive mass incarceration in the United States and make us such an outlier in the world. We're looking at all different certificates and things that people need when they come home to get into certain careers, but they're barred to get into those careers because of the felony on their record, like being an EMT. You can go to college and be the most incredible EMT, but you cannot get certified if you have a felony on your record. We're going to end that and look at all the other areas that prevent people that had made a mistake in their youth from getting into these careers. And that's the policy side. But then there's a third side. And this is a side that is not as obvious, but to me, it's the narrative change side, the storytelling side, the side where we have to change public opinion about who these folks are. Because if you watch the news every night, you see horrible crime after horrible crime. And it's very easy to say, if you don't know these folks, I want to lock them up and throw away the key because I want to be safe in my home at night. I want my kids to be safe. I want my neighborhood to be safe. And we need to change public opinion to show them the beauty of change, the beauty of transformation, and that people can change, and that we need to support that change, and we need to support redemption, and we need to attack injustice, and we need to support justice, and to support proportionality, and to support rehabilitation. And so this narrative change element of having our members tell their stories and getting those stories out through social media or through news segments, et cetera, to move people, to move our voters, to move our electorate, to change hearts and minds, that's the third piece of what we do, and I think the most important piece.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that that I love that ARC does, Anti-Recidivism Coalition, is, I guess people who don't know just don't know, but if you're a person who's been incarcerated and you get out, the day you get out and they, you know, you've seen it in the movies, you know, they go out, you go out the door and there you are. For a lot of people, sad but true, they have no one.
It can be kind of scary.
To get them at that door. Maybe because they're in Pelican Bay and their families are all the way down in L.A. and they just can't afford to get up there to get the person coming out. Or maybe all the bridges have been burned. Or all their loved ones are deceased.
Yes.
So here you are, it's your day of freedom, and there's nobody there, and they put you with, I don't know how much they give you nowadays, and then on a bus, and you're on your own. I just love that your organization sees to it that as people are being released, there's somebody there to take them where? Someplace, right?
Yeah, that's our ride home program, and it's actually run by someone who spent a decade in prison, Carlos Cervantes, and his partner Roby So, and others. And our folks who have all spent time behind bars are the ones that pick up someone that's coming out and has no family left and maybe has spent 30, 40 years in prison. Yeah. And we take them to get their first meal. We love to take them to get their first Starbucks. And none of them can ever figure out what a venti and grande and mochaccino and all these,
it's
all these
just
things.
Too many choices.
And take them to get their clothes, and we buy them their first few outfits, and then bring them to a reentry program down in Los Angeles or wherever they're going. But I found out that literally out of all 58 counties, there are only 10 counties that have reentry programs. That means there's 48 counties that if you don't have family, you are homeless.
Yes. Oh, man. Oh, wow. Scott Budnick, founder of Anti-Recidivism Coalition, and I'm here with, I call him Young Brother T, and I'm Sharon, and we're discussing the work of Scott Budnick and the people that help him with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. You know, I'm remembering the day that Troy was leaving the gates of San Quentin, and Mike DeBronx, my husband, went to get him. And, well, you should tell the story.
Well, I got let out on a weekend, and I got let out real early in the morning. And Mike came to pick me up in his truck, and we got in the truck, and all the while, sister, going through all of the gates to let you out, I kept thinking that someone was gonna call or say, "Hey, this is a mistake. This guy isn't supposed to be getting out or something," you know. So every gate that I passed through, I got a little bit more happier, but a little bit more kind of like apprehensive until I got past that last gate and I saw Mike waiting for me.
And what'd you say to him?
Well, we got in the truck and I told Mike, I said, "Mike, let's get out of here before they change their minds," you know.
Yeah.
And we just rolled up out of there.
But that's a real feeling, you know. Scott, have you experienced that from any of these men or women that have come out like that? Like, is this real? And
exactly.
Am I really free, you know?
Yeah, all the time. Mm. All the time. Mm. I mean, Troy knows it better than anyone. It's just a process, and some people want to move fast, some want to move slow, some don't know how to move at all, and
right.
It's just being there to be present.
Hey, you know, with the firefighting program, you know, it's a trip because there were many times I was in prison, and I'd have a cellie, and we'll see the fires, and we'll get to talking, you know, and we'll be like, "Man, you know, I wouldn't mind being out there helping to fight those fires, you know, like doing something, you know." And I always thought it was like ridiculous, but also a waste that guys can fight fires while they're within the CDC, while they have a number, but once the number was no longer there on them, they couldn't get a job. I always looked at it like, hey, that's a waste of resources, because those guys learn how fires behave, you know. And that's something you can't read in a book. You know, you have to be there and fought the fire and, you know, experienced it. And I always thought it was a shame that all that talent would go to waste, you know, especially in a state where we really need that, you know.
Absolutely. Hey, Scott, what in all of this time, all this work, since the first time you went to Juvie Hall, what frustrations have you personally like felt in all of this work? Because I've always been amazed at the access that you have gotten. I mean, back in the day, nobody was getting into Pelican Bay, really. I mean, I think after 60 Minutes did that story when they scalded that poor man practically to death. It was like a shutdown. You couldn't get into these prisons to talk to anybody about anything. You've had great access, but any frustrations along the way to this moment in time?
I mean, not really. I mean, you have your day-to-day frustrations, and you obviously have your people that just do not believe in rehabilitation and are going to do everything they can, especially people that work in the system.
Right.
I mean, you just have your knuckleheads, your knuckle draggers, your people that don't see these folks as human and believe it's their job to just make everything miserable.
Exactly.
But like, I've decided, I made a conscious choice and said, I'm not going to consume myself with those people. Because there's people, if you look hard enough and deep enough, there's people that are the opposite of that. There's people that you can find people in the system that believe strongly in rehabilitation. You could find a self-help sponsor or a warden or even a captain or folks in there who may be wearing a prison guard uniform but have bought into this. And so I try to put most of my energy into the people that have bought into this and are our allies, and not on the people who just are angry themselves and angry at their own lives and wanting to inflict misery on everyone else. Because even if I have somebody that's trying to stop me from doing what I'm in there to do and just wants to make things difficult, I've made enough relationships at this point where I can just go over them or around them and I just don't need their energy.
Yeah. Let me share something with you. A couple of weeks ago, Troy got to spend the weekend with a former prison guard / counselor. You know, when you're a guard, the cherry job is to become a counselor, you know, right? The people who manage your files and things of that nature. It's not a counselor like we think of, you know, you're going to counseling. But he spent the weekend with a former guard who was his counselor many, many years ago. We were not going to say his name. And they spent the weekend together.
Went camping. Not camping, but we went hiking.
Yeah. And just share some of the things he told you about how it was for him. Because this was a very decent man. He wrote a really poignant chrono on Troy's behalf some time ago. And I told Troy when he got out, I said, Troy, we got to get in touch with so-and-so. Because he wrote you that beautiful letter. He would love to know that you landed on your feet. And we did. We made a brief connection. And then this guy, who we're speaking of with no name, saw Troy on 60 Minutes with Oprah Winfrey, and he sent us a letter. And that's how Troy got to go spend the weekend with him. And he shared, Troy's going to tell you some of the things he shared about, you know, being a guard and a prisoner when you're trying to be a decent person.
Being a decent person in a place where, you know, decency isn't always, you know, encouraged. You know, it was hard. You know, I mean, he, you know, tried to do right. He did right by me, of course, and he tried to do right by other prisoners. But as a result of that, you know, his coworkers, they kind of like gave him a hard time. You know, and you know, there are people in there that are trying to be decent, that are trying to make a connection with the prisoners and let them know, like, hey, you know what, you know, I'm in green, but, you know, I see you as part of humanity too. But then there's their voice is oftentimes drowned out by the people that are in there that are trying to tell the prisoners, like, hey, you know, you are no longer a part of society and you guys are nothing, you know. So there's always that challenge going on in there, you know.
Yeah, I think it's so rare that, you know, a former inmate has the opportunity to sit and break bread.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway. All right, I'm with Scott Budnick. We got about 12 minutes left. Your calls are still welcome. 826-480-5, 1-800-640-5911, 826-4805. I'm Sharon. I'm here with Troy and Scott on the line. Scott, let's talk about good films and... Do you have any roles for senior citizens?
Oh, my God, you're funny. it's so exciting. I've been spending the last 2 years pitching an idea to investors about how to tell stories in feature films and television shows around this issue to humanize the people that are behind our prison walls and to make huge movies and feature films that have worldwide distribution. I mean, when I made The Hangover, they spent $100 million just to market the movie. And
dang.
So you couldn't turn on a basketball game without seeing Hangover ads.
Yeah.
And I want to tell stories about the incredible work of folks like Troy in films and television shows to change hearts and minds and show people to really change the way people think, feel, act, and even vote. And I always use the example of marriage equality in talking about gay marriage, that 10 years ago, gay marriage was illegal everywhere, and now gay marriage is legal everywhere. And how do you get, I mean, talk about impact and change around a political issue. How did they get there? And when you talk to anyone that was involved in that struggle and that political movement, and you say, what were the largest moments that were the game-changing moments in that? And literally the first thing they say is Will and Grace.
Oh, yeah.
And then they say Ellen DeGeneres,
right,
and Modern Family.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally was pop culture where people in middle America that were so against gay marriage watched a TV show for 10 years, fell in love with characters who happened to be gay, and at the end of it, really didn't care about gay marriage anymore. And if you look at that example and look at all other issues of inequality and injustice,
right,
whether it be prison, whether it be foster care, whether it be immigration,
poverty,
whether it be inequality for women and girls, or inequality in education systems, poverty and economic justice, that these are issues that can be moved by changing the hearts and minds of the people who are voting on these issues and putting these politicians in place to vote on these issues.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to create film and television and documentary and digital and everything else to move those issues and to see change in those issues, just like we saw change in marriage equality.
So are these going to be like a documentary style or like, a full-length movie about the life of so-and-so? What do you envision?
Did you say like in terms of the kinds of movies?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at everything, and it's not just criminal justice reform, but I look at everything from Lion, which really touched me around issues of foster care and orphans, to Spotlight, to Moonlight, to 12 Years a Slave, to even like that Will Smith movie, Pursuit of Happiness, to TV shows like Making of a Murderer on Netflix, or even that podcast Serial that people were really tuning into to hear about a criminal case. To even like theater, like I could see us doing good films, doing something like Hamilton. But really what we want to do is alongside the telling of these stories and the making of these films, run massive political campaigns and legislation and philanthropic campaigns alongside the release of the film.
So the money that these films would generate, some of that money would then be used for a good cause?
Absolutely. That's why it's called Good Films, girl.
Yeah. I once stayed in a little hotel in San Francisco called the Good Hotel. So that's a good name for it. That's good. Good is good, right?
Yeah.
So when will you give birth to Good Films? When will we see a good film?
So we just announced it in Sundance at the Sundance Film Festival.
Oh, right.
We will be up and running by May. So I'm getting office space. We're actually housing Good Films at ARC. Half of my staff, if not more, will be formally incarcerated. All of my staff will either be women or people of color, because we need to do something about the huge lack of diversity in Hollywood.
Absolutely.
It ain't going to be Oscars so white. It's going to, we're going to do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
On our films, when we make films, we'll probably be making about 6 films a year in television, et cetera.
How many? Six
movies a year.
Oh, six.
As well as television and documentaries on top of that. And we're going to be hiring dozens, if not hundreds, of people who have experienced incarceration to work in union jobs on those films.
So
there's going to be just, and again, ARC and Good Films will be under the same roof. So there's just going to be a huge synergy in terms of the work we're all doing to show redemption and transformation.
All right. We have an off-air caller.
Yes, we do. Thanks for calling. They just wanted to know if there was any way they could volunteer at Pelican Bay.
Interesting.
Scott?
There is a community resource manager at Pelican Bay that oversees all the volunteers. His name is Robert Losacco. And you can email Robert Losacco at Robert.Losacco, L-O-S as in Sam, A-C-C-O, at cdcr.ca.gov. Robert.Losacco at cdcr.ca.gov.
All right, there you go. Go volunteer up at Pelican Bay. There are a lot of people in my community that are volunteering up there right now, Scott, as we speak. A lot of, there's theater going on up there. Did you know that? I think it's Del Arte, is up there. And there's someone that's doing writing up there. And, just all kinds of things like they used to have until Governor Schwarzenegger took that money away, and so it's coming back. Arts in the prisons.
And also, I wanted to also thank an incredible Institute of Higher Learning, the College of the Redwoods. Some amazing professors from the College of the Redwoods, really passionate professors, are going into Pelican Bay 5 nights a week and teaching college classes that earn these men an associate's degree. And of course, just like any volunteer, they were very timid at first and scared. But once they went in and saw how dedicated these men were to their education and how appreciative they were, they all say that the men that they're teaching in Pelican Bay are actually better students and care more than most of the students in the community that are on their phones and texting during class and acting like children.
Yeah.
Shout out to the College of the Redwoods.
Yeah, well, it's hard to text when you're in prison because you don't have a phone, but, you know, just saying.
Some do.
Some do. Yeah,
so quick shout out to my man Jose Flores over there that's been bringing in all types of programs, Defy Ventures. Shout out to my man Daryl. Just want to give thanks to the men over there at Pelican Bay that are really doing the work to bring in rehabilitation programs and to embrace this positive change.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, Scott. We got just like 2 minutes left. Before they're up, I want to thank you and Troy for sharing with us this really sea change in how we see the people that are changing, you know.
I want to thank Scott because as someone that's been in there, we've hoped and prayed for this thing to come in terms of people reaching out to us to like, hey, you know, help us get along the way, you know.
Thanks. It's great work. And also, you know, next time you come up this way, you know what you should do, right? Okay. We'll leave it like that. Come see me.
I know. I got to. I just want to say God bless the two of you.
Oh, thanks.
And this is, it's just so beautiful. I was so depressed when you ended the show, and to be able to rekindle it for an hour and hear your voice and hear Troy, and I just got a big smile on my face.
You
are the people that just bring kind of love and positive energy and positive spirit to the community, to the folks in Pelican Bay, and I just can't thank you and love you anymore.
Well, right back at you. Scott Budnick, Anti-Recidivism Coalition, and soon to be Good Films coming right up. We thank you again. Thanks, everybody, for listening in, and I'll be back next month with who knows what. Peace out. Thanks, Michael. All right. Bye, Scott. Right.
See you, Scott.
Yeah, Troy.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our hosts, Sharon Fennell and Troy Williams, and to our guest, Scott Budnick. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Eric Kirk is hosting next week on Thursday Night Talk. Thanks to Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name's Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. It's 8 o'clock. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.